7 minutes beyond our starting time, so we'll get on with it. This is the review of the ESSAC. The ESSAC review working group was established now 15 months ago. So we're coming to the end of this process. It's a long and slow process, but a very very satisfactory one from my point of view as chair of the ESSAC review working group, in that I feel that it stimulated the ESSAC to do its own review and therefore was very helpful, I think, to the ESSAC. But anyway, let's review where we are. Can I turn over to you, Marco, to look at the... Steve.
Just a preliminary, concurrent with this session, the root scaling study presentation is in progress. Suzanne Wolf and a number of other people who would ordinarily want to be here sort of obliged to be there. So with apologies for the limited representation.
I understand, and there's a public participation committee meeting starting shortly, which I'm supposed to be at. So there's a lot of overlap here. So we just make the best use of the time we can, I think, is all we can do. Okay, Marco, can I ask you to start?
Thank you, Dennis. And let's have a look to the summary of our very long and very boring presentation. First of all, I would like to have a look to the timeline with you, so where we are, when we started, and where the final recommendations of the working group can be expected. And then we'll have a look to reviewers' recommendations, finally, to the draft working group conclusions for final consultation. Let's start with the timeline. As Dennis mentioned, the independent review was started in 2008, October, and finished in February 2009. And by the way, Jeff Schmidt from the consulting group carried out such an excellent job, is here in this room. Thanks, Jeff. Hi. And after the delivery of the draft final report, which was presented in Mexico City, we had a phase of public comments. This allowed to finalize the report from the external consultant. After this phase, we experienced for the first time in the ICANN history a new formula of getting inputs from the community under review, so under the initiative of the Security and Stability Committee, and in coordination with the working group, they carried out a self-review exercise which answered to all the main points, to all the recommendations that were contained in reviewers' recommendation. This was a very important input for the work of the working group and allowed this working group to produce a draft final report in an extremely short period of time in comparison with what we experienced in other reviews. Basically, this working group worked from July to October to produce the text of the report that is now up for public comments. Was going to happen. We have the public comment phase, which will expire the 22nd of November. Then, based on the inputs that we are going to receive through the public comment phase, the working group will going to finalize its report, and very likely the final version of the report will be ready by January 2010. The point of departure of this exercise was the final output of independent reviewers, which contains 33 recommendations. 33 could seem a very large number, but by no means it means that several and major critical issues were noticed in the SAC, as many of those recommendations recommended to keep the current state of practice or to introduce very small changes. So there were very detailed recommendations on three different clusters. The first were 14 recommendations on organizational clarity and charter, a second cluster of recommendations on formality and transparency, and then a last group of recommendations on conflict of interest. The structure of this presentation is very much similar to the structure of the draft final report that you have for public comments. So you will see a very brief resume of the reviewers' recommendations, what has been the position of the SAC on this or this recommendations, and then the conclusions of the working group. They are sequential, and let's go through all of them. And would you prefer to take comments one by one or at the end of the workshop?
Well, if there are comments as we go through it quickly, if people want to flag it, either ESSAC people, but on the other hand, if the ESSAC position and the working group conclusions are in agreement, let's not belabor the point and only stop if there are other comments from the audience that need to be taken. So I suggest, Marco, we go pretty quickly through this and rely on people, give people enough time to see what's on the slides, but otherwise rely on people to raise the hand if they have a query and move on, except where there may be disagreement between the ESSAC working position and the working group conclusions.
Great. So we have a first group of four recommendations which, with the full agreement from both SAC and the working group conclusions. Let's move quickly to the recommendation number five, which was extremely important for the overall construct of this report and the logic of the whole set of recommendations. The point of departure was about the recommendation from reviewers to amend the SAC charter in order to exclude dealing with confidential or proprietary information, absent specific guidance from the board. SAC disagreed with this formulation, considering that In particular regard to the composition of the committee, so composition made up of security professionals who deal very often with private information, this recommendation was not opportune to be implemented. The working group tried to spell out even further this set of recommendations and came to the conclusion to the following recommendation. There is an agreement in general with the comments formulated by SAC, so there is no need to amend its charter. It is considered that SAC has a legitimate right to ask for access to confidential or proprietary information that is needed to fill its mandate, and this request for accessing to proprietary or confidential information evidently needs to be motivated by appropriate reasons. The fact that SAC has the right to ask for access to confidential or proprietary information does not mean that they have the right to force ICANN or any other organization to disclose confidential or proprietary information. The working group suggests that the CEO and or the board, if needed, would decide on access to this confidential information, which in case of disclosure should be treated under the terms to be set by the owner of the information. One point that was discussed, but this is a synthesis of a synthesis, so by need is a very short definition of the text contained in the report. One point that has been discussed, and you will reflect it in the text of the report, is the issue of enforceability of the terms for disclosing the confidential information. So this is an aspect that has to be taken into consideration when the CEO or the board will decide for the disclosing of public information, of confidential information.
So are there any, since there's some disagreement there, any comment from anybody, from any ESSEC member or from the audience?
I don't want to get into a lengthy thing here, and since we're pretty much in agreement anyway, I'll just note that as you noted at the outset, that we're in the process of instituting a set of changes which are sort of consistent with this. And so by the time the report comes out, we ought to be able to hand you our operational procedures that are implement our version of these. And one can then take a finer grain look and see where the details are.
Thanks, Steve. Yes. Okay, next slide.
Next slide is about the possibility for SAC to review internal ICANN operations. And the initial position was to amend the Charter of SAC in order to exclude this possibility. SAC pointed out that this provision would hamper its analysis. So apart from the normal exclusion of contracts or other employment practices would not allow to disclose information, SAC should have access and should have, if motivated, the possibility to review internal ICANN operations. The working group concluded that it is in the interest of ICANN that SAC signal to the ICANN board and the management whenever it considers that there are potential threats to the security and stability of the Internet caused by ICANN's internal operations. Contemporarily, it unanimously agreed in saying that the ICANN internal operations, including IANA, should report to the board after each security and stability incident and annually on the measures adopted to face major threats. And the board will decide on the partial or full disclosure of this report to SAC as appropriate. This was another major point of discussion in the working group and with the SAC community.
Steve?
I remember sending, when you had published these before, a set of specific responses, and one of them, I think, was related to this. But the wording here, I don't remember if it's exactly the same as what I saw before. I presume it is. And perhaps I, now that I reread this, what I responded to before is not the overall structure is fine. It's the focus on incidents as the trigger for what to think about as opposed to, or incidents certainly have to be paid attention to. Much of what ESSEC has been concerned about are not so much driven by incidents but are driven by perceptions of structural weaknesses which one wants to address before there are incidents. And I was concerned a little bit in the way that this was worded, that it was narrowly focused on being driven by incidents as opposed to a broader set of things to be concerned about.
Thank you, Steve. Just if I could respond, I think the first paragraph there is intended to allow ESSEC to flag to the board its concerns.
And now that I read it, that I'm not sure that I may have missed that, and I apologize if I did. But I certainly was. I remember responding to internally, you know, thinking that the focus on incidents in the second paragraph was of concern if it was too narrow.
Well, I don't think that's narrow for ESSEC. It is somewhat narrow for IANA's reporting. And what it's trying to say is that if anything goes wrong, IANA has a requirement, and indeed generally, to report to the board, and annually anyway to report. So the incidence is really to say to IANA, look, if something's happened, you're supposed to report it to the board. Yeah. Okay? Yes. Please come to a microphone and identify yourself for the record.
John Curran, President and CEO, Aaron, American Registry of Internet Numbers. The SSAC provides a valuable function for the RIR community that on a day-in and day-out basis doesn't spend a lot of time worried about the security of the infrastructure for the services provided by IANA to the RIR community. To this end, the RIR community certainly is in a circumstance where we rely on the ability of the SSAC to identify proactively problems in the infrastructure or the operation of the infrastructure. That's the function, that's ICANN's organization to provide that function. To that end, making that be reactive instead of proactive, which is what this draft conclusion states, doesn't allow the SSAC to take a leadership role if there's a problem with operations, such as internal procedures for managing RPKI. This doesn't discover them until after there's a situation. To this end, if this draft conclusion continues the way it is, the board should be advised that the address supporting organization of ICANN is likely to instigate multiple occasions where the board reports back to the ASO rather than the ASO and the RIRs working directly with SSAC. So as this conclusion is written, I just point out the board also has to remember it reports to constituencies of the supporting organizations.
Thank you for that. I think we do remember that. Let me tease that out a little bit more. I thought that the first paragraph expressed there gives the appropriate power to SSAC to signal to the management and board, you know, when it considers there are potential threats. I thought that was more would more than adequately cover the point. If it doesn't, I'm not sure that I understand why it doesn't.
So I'm wondering how the SSAC can signal to the ICANN board that it considers as a potential threat when it's excluded from review of operations and operational procedures. How does it know that there's a problem to be signaled to the board if its charter up front excludes review of internal ICANN operations, including IANA?
For the record, I never met this guy, and I have no idea how he got in here. But
well, I would have thought that it'd be if there are if there's no evidence of any problems, then you know, the issue here is not having intrusive and disruptive investigations when there is absolutely no need, and finding the balance to get that right. Okay. We the working group took the view that it is inappropriate to allow any time, anywhere, under any basis, SSAC, who are undoubted experts, but they are individuals from all sorts of organizations, to examine and query and explore in a way that might be quite disruptive. So we've tried as a working group to find the right balance to give power to the SSAC to say, you know, whether they have some reason to be concerned. And what that puts is the responsibility on the board and management to respond to that. And as I say, also if there is an incident, to force IANA to report it. Now, our understanding is that one of the issues, one of the perceptions, is that there are incidents which are not reported, and this recommendation would require that IANA report internally. So that's the balance we're trying to get. And you can see that there are extremes here which are unacceptable to various parties.
I appreciate the balance that's being struck. Regarding the need for reporting, I actually have no view or opinion one way or another. It is, however, the regional internet registry system's requirement that the IANA operations be performed with a high level of integrity. And we don't per se deal in worrying about that because there's an organization called the ESSAC involved. To this end, I guess to strike that delicate balance we're talking about, we should drive it to a simple question. When those internal procedures are changed, is there a consideration that they're changed in a way that's sufficiently material that would be brought by not the board, which is a fairly heavy function, but perhaps the staff would bring that to the ESSAC for subsequent review? We know that happens on the establishment of some of these procedures now, and I actually think it happens for some of the material changes. I guess that's what we're looking for, is this is an exclusionary function. It's not an inclusionary function that says we realize we have an obligation for review with the community when we're establishing or changing these procedures.
George, yes, if you'd come in first.
Yeah, thank you. There's obviously history here that, or either real or imagined, that I'm not privy to. But I'd just like to ask Steve a simple question. Steve, to your, to the best of your ability, as you read these working group conclusions, do they inhibit the ESSAC's ability to do its job as you see it?
Thank you, George. So there is some history here, and just to have a level playing field in the discussion, much of what generated these issues with the external review and so forth were in fact driven by incidents that came to attention, and then we attempted to initiate a review and were pushed back. And that just sort of festered for some long time, and we're all pretty mature and have the balance of public responsibility on the one hand, and an understanding of not wanting to have a operation be intruded on. Each of us has run operations and knows that having every gadfly marching in and saying, you know, you owe us the responsibility to open up everything all the time would be intolerable. So the question is, what is the right balance there? And I'm strongly in agreement with that. This recommendation here probably needs to be put in juxtaposition with the previous ones that you've put up, where and maybe it would be worth rolling back. I don't remember whether it's the previous one or the one before. This one is I think deals with it. ESSAC has a legitimate right to ask for access to confidential proprietary information to fulfill its needs, and I think the balance that's attempted to be struck here with recommendation 5 is that ESSAC could, for example, on whatever basis it chooses, and I'll list them in a second because we're into an area that I think is worth having some discussion about, could say, we would like to look at the IANA function and look at these things. And what 5 says here is that should be mediated through the CEO and the board rather than just arbitrary. And if they say no in a way that we would feel inappropriate, or if they say no too often, then we have a tension that has to be resolved at a higher level. Now, the kind of thing that you're raising, John, which I think is who set you up here? This is perfect. I couldn't have done a better job of inviting you in at the exactly right time. But
I probably read too much about ICANN.
I think there are maybe two helpful things that work within the framework that's established and can't be, maybe shouldn't be dictated exactly, but I'll tell you how I would interpret things. First, I think your formulation that whenever there's a material change in the operations within IANA, that is a signal for at least asking for a review. And the second is, I think on a regular basis, say, you know, for the sake of argument, once a year, to schedule a pro forma review in which we sit down and go through all the systems and ask for that. And those can be done within the framework that's established here by 5 and 6, And if everybody's cooperative and sensible, would we'll go through smoothly. And if they don't go through, well, then, as I say, we got a bigger problem that isn't going to be dealt with within these formulations. So the short answer to your question, George, is yes, but I wanted to give the long answer first.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. I think we've tried, the working group has tried to get the balance right. But if I just might comment, the information that the RIRs rely on ESSAC was, I don't think, known to the external reviewers, and certainly was not known to me as chair of the working group. So perhaps one of the things that we should look at these conclusions in the light of that information, and perhaps we could get that dependency more precisely defined so we'd review it and see whether it's within the terms of reference of the ESSAC working group or not, review working group, or whether it's a different problem entirely that needs to be addressed, because it wasn't known to me that there was an operational dependence on ESSAC as an advisory committee. And my initial reaction is perhaps that's a bit strange, and perhaps that's a substitute for something more fundamental, which is IANA's reporting routinely to its clients in an appropriate manner. Now, since I'm a bit ignorant, I don't really want to... When in a hole, Dennis, stop digging, I think, is the first rule. So maybe, John, maybe outside this meeting you could provide me with a short briefing as to the issue so that we decide whether it's something the review working group should look at. Steve, you want to comment?
Yeah, I didn't know either that we were carrying that load. Sort of stepping out, sort of an outer body experience here. Looking at this, I would have to say that sort of ESSAC was invented, as we know, kind of in a response to 9/11 without any specifics and clarity, and then we began to do whatever we began to do. And I think what I'm certainly hearing as well for the first time is that, in fact, others have been dependent upon us in a way that, had we not been there, other mechanisms might have evolved. And your point, Dennis, is maybe those mechanisms should be there because that would be the more formal and straightforward thing to do. And I don't necessarily disagree. I'm having quite mixed feelings of, well, gosh, I didn't know that we'd actually been doing anything useful. That's good to know. But I also didn't know that we were carrying a responsibility, and now there's questions about sort of what is that precisely, and are we doing a good enough job, and so forth.
Just to clarify, the in-adder domains, which are used for people to map backwards from numbers to names, actually turn out to be pretty important for a lot of applications. And while they occupy a very small amount of the DNS namespace, they potentially have larger impact, if not available, on a wider scope. And so people don't think about the RIRs when they think about DNS, but we have a slice that was required to be operational, which we don't spend a lot of attention worrying about because we recognize there's an expert group doing that. And so this is not a question of reporting. We actually have a wonderful relationship with IANA, and we actually have formal reporting that has been set up between the NRO acting as the address supporting organization and the IANA. We want to make sure that the IANA has access to resources of expertise when making significant changes, because a mistake made in that organization can have wide-reaching impact.
Jeff, you wanted to comment?
Jeff Schmidt, JAS. It is not my intention to get involved in this. However, I wanted to ask, because I too am very intrigued by this. The stated dependency was that you rely on ESSAC to ensure the correct operation of IANA. Is that a fair restatement of what you said?
We rely on the fact that ESSAC is out there so that IANA doesn't provide insecure operations.
Right.
Okay. Slightly different, but yes.
So may I turn that around and say, You depend on the correct functioning of IANA, and to date, ESSAC has helped you feel good about that correct functioning of IANA. but really your dependency is on the correct functioning of IANA.
The Regional Internet Registry System has not put resources into reviewing IANA's stability and security because we presumed that that would be something that the SSAC would be paying attention to.
Okay.
So if it's not in charter for it to do so for significant changes and development procedures, we can spin that up and subject IANA to it, but then you'd have two of them, and that's probably not what anyone wants.
My intent with the question was if we missed a dependency or a relationship, then I want to know about it. It sounds like, I mean, there are many folks, everyone in this room that's an internet user included, that has critical dependencies on the proper functioning of IANA. And it sounds like that is also your dependency, that you need IANA to be working, but it is not necessarily a unique dependency. And SSAC has been in a position to make you feel good about that. Okay, but really it's ICANN's responsibility, however implemented, SSAC or other mechanisms, to make sure that IANA is functioning
correctly. Okay, now we could beat this to death. I think the point has been well made. So
I need to respond directly to a comment he just made.
Yes, a quick response from you and then from Ram, and then could we close this point and move on?
To be clear, our reliance is not a general reliance. The ASO, the Address Supporting Organization, is a piece of IANA, okay? We do not have the general public's need for the IANA to perform correctly and ICANN's general responsibility. We have a contractual relationship between the RIRs, a Memorandum of Understanding, and ICANN, and we need ICANN to securely operate its piece of that infrastructure. So, yes, you could turn around and say it's ICANN's duty, but I'm going to be clear. It's ICANN's duty to us as a supporting organization.
Ram, would you like to comment?
Thank you. Two comments. This recommendation does not assist SSAC in identifying systemic issues that do not appear to be problems until analysis is first conducted. For example, there is currently, I have been told, an IANA automation plan. This has been developed by staff. But as far as I know, SSAC as a committee has been explicitly excluded from either having access to it or to review and provide a response. As an SSAC member, it's difficult to find out whether this significant change in how IANA functions has security or stability concerns, which then might prompt SSAC to actually come to the board or the CEO and say, we request a review. This is simply an example, but this recommendation puts SSAC in a really tough spot because we're supposed to guess what's going on inside a black box and figure out maybe something is wrong and then explicitly state to the board or the CEO what might be going wrong so that the board or the CEO could come to a decision on it. I find that pretty hard to actually do in real life. The second point is it seems to me that in the implementation of this recommendation, there's a possibility of the introduction of a level of bureaucracy and inefficiency I'm not certain is necessary. It is not clear to me, for instance, that there is a responsibility of the board or the CEO to define why such access, should SSAC ask for such access, why such access is denied. It is also not clear whether, if such information is provided, that information can be shared with the SSAC members themselves. All of this adds to process and extra bureaucracy inside of SSAC, taking it away from its core function. Last thing, this is bigger than just the IANA function. We're talking about this as if it's an IANA function with the prior history or issues that have happened between SSAC and ICANN and the IANA function. But let's just think about where ICANN is going. For example, there is a plan currently for ICANN staff to create a DNS cert. Under this outcome, potentially, SAC would have to ask the board or the CEO information on non-public aspects of this and try to find out what might be in such a proposed DNS cert that could cause a security or stability concern. I find that to be a circular requirement, and as an SAC member, it seems very difficult to actually do its job.
Thank you, Ram. George, I'll come back to you in a minute, Ram. George?
Ram has vocalized my previously felt uncertainty and lack of, well, not lack of, but my concern regarding the recommendations. It seems to me if we have an organization that is focused on security, then to hobble them in ways that are, I agree, increasingly bureaucratic in this formulation seems rather stupid.
Thanks, George. It's interesting. Maybe my management perspective reads the first paragraph under the conclusions very differently. But the way I read that, if you're saying that there is a potential threat to the security and stability of the Internet because of this cert activity, and you assert that, well, you know because it's a change, a major change. You don't know that it has caused, it's a proposal, but I would interpret that to say, look, guys, and not just IANA, but the internal operations, you're proposing to make some major change here. We believe that is a sufficiently major change that there is a potential threat. We want to flag that to you, and we want to arrange with you to have a review of that. That's the way I read that, and that's certainly my intention in that paragraph as chair of the working group, to empower you to do all sorts of to flag all sorts of things. What it doesn't address, I was just pointing out, is if in your view you're unreasonably denied, what is your recourse? And that is, of course, has to be to the CEO and the board. There's no other mechanism for resolving those things.
Actually, there is one other, which is we can simply report that we've been denied, and then the public becomes party to it.
So, Ram, that's the way I read that. That would empower ESSAC to be to basically raise a flag and say, look, we think we ought to have a look at any particular area, and then to which would require ICANN to engage with the ESSAC. I think it's a very, the way I read that, that's a very powerful tool.
Dennis, I understand. The way I read that, it's a very powerful bureaucratic mechanism, because what it'll require ESSAC to do is, for every identified change that ICANN makes, ESSAC will have to write a note into the board or the CEO asking for a review, because we fear there may be potential threats to the security and stability. I think it's bureaucratic, and I think it's inefficient for ICANN and its staff as well. That's something you should consider.
I hear you, yeah. Clearly, we're trying to provide an appropriate intercept between the concerns of ESSAC and the concerns of ICANN as an organization. And particularly in the security and stability arena, where no matter, you know, ICANN is as open and transparent as it can be, and I'm one of the board members who would insist on that, and balance that with the need to be prudent as an organization. So all I say, why don't we try and give it a whirl? I mean, I think I've empowered you. If this hasn't empowered you, we'll come back to it. Is the best I can offer. And I'm as sensitive to the history, although I don't know none of the details, as I hope everybody else is.
How would you come back to it? Doesn't this working group shut down after the results are done?
Well, the implementation phase, I think I need notice of that question. I'm not sure.
Let me. There's a certain amount of irony in all of this, because I've certainly had a very stringent position, and I'm now finding that my colleagues on the my colleagues on the right are, and I'm in the middle here, are taking up the charge. Let me suggest, Ram, that one of the reasons why I'm not too worked up here is because, yes, there's a degree of bureaucracy here, and so I have this mental image of a pad of pre-printed forms, if you will. Dear board, please open up access to this. Joking aside, I actually have in mind that we should exercise this, not leave it fallow, and put it to the test. And there's a small queue of things, including the root zone management system, just to pick the one of the ones that's very large and sitting there for that purpose. That will serve that purpose. So we can put this to the test. The other thing is that although it increases the bureaucracy, no doubt, we have failed in the past with the informal requests. And putting these requests on the record may actually have a salutary effect on the whole thing. So I can see a balance here that doesn't necessarily work as I wouldn't necessarily have gravitated toward this at first, and in fact, I didn't. I assumed that we had access and assumed that we could get in, and so I was somewhat surprised and disheartened. But if this is the way we want to set things up, then I think we just go through the form of it, that we build the record, and then it becomes in a way, this is a stick that we have both ends are holding onto, and although, in one sense they can push back, we can push as well. So I think it binds us in both directions and is not necessarily as awkward to work with.
Yes. Thank you, Steve. I think you've got exactly what I was trying to intimate without wanting to state it so explicitly. Let me suggest
that 30 years of working in bureaucracies. Yeah.
Let me suggest that one of the ways to address Ram's question, perhaps we should put in there at the end that the working group should review the operation of this. I don't want to craft words now, at some period, let's say in 12 months' time, to see whether this has successfully addressed the issues that
That. I mean, with that, then I have some certainty that this, you know, this just doesn't become a, an issue that has been resolved when it might not work. So I can live with that. Thank you.
Okay, let's make a note of that. We will put in some review mechanism here so that there is a way of doing it. And John, perhaps you'd also put on the record through the public comment process your concerns in more detail. Yeah?
Certainly.
Thank you. Yes, Jeff, quick comment.
So, again, not to stir, the reason why this, this was obviously the issue in the report. This was, there's more energy, spent on this topic than any other topic on all sides. I want to state that it is not the reviewer's position that these reviews of internal operations should not be done. They obviously should be done because of the gigantic dependencies that exist. Our issue, and you can read about it in the paper, was entirely a governance issue. And there are other options for solving this problem. They're discussed in the paper, but things like, keeping a subset under contract of SSAC folks to look at these things. There are other options. We don't have to just work within the confines here, but solving the governance issue is the appropriate path.
Thanks, Jeff. Let's move on to recommendation 7.
Recommendation number 7, which is about SAC independence, and the point of departure was the recommendation to correct the perception of the SAC independence through improvements in formality, transparency, and increased board interaction without limiting SAC freedom of expression. There has been a very interesting discussion within the SAC review team and with the working group about even the status of individual SAC members, and the common conclusion of the working group, which is an agreement, by the way, with the SAC position, is that the fact there is no contradiction between the status of several SAC members as employees and their efforts, their commitment to provide technical analytic work. So no measures are suggested to be adopted to address this remark. Number eight. As you know, it's now practice since I think 1 year that the SAC chair and the SAC board liaison are not the same individual. The recommendation number eight discusses whether this has to be reflected in the charter of the SAC or not. And the common position of both the SAC and the working group is that this does not have to be reflected in the charter of the SAC, leaving it completely to the discretion of the committee. I'm moving pretty fast. If I see somebody raising his hands, I stop for discussion, evidently. Number nine is about reimbursement of travel expenses. There is an agreement on the possibility to study the issue of paying a stipend or honorarium to leadership. It's pretty interesting, the discussion on recommendation number 11. It's about the possibility for excluding non-technical risk to security and to specifically include within the SAC charter non-technical risk to security and stability. And the conclusion. The conclusion of the working group is that SAC has already demonstrated his ability to analyze technical consequences of non-technical decisions, and it doesn't seem opportune to amend the SAC charter in the sense that has been suggested. Number 12 is on maintaining focus on developing and sharing knowledge and understanding of new and evolving risk. There is an agreement with both the SAC review and the reviewer's recommendation. Number 13 is another area of agreement about improving sensitivity to political and business issues. Several measures were suggested and agreement. No action is required because actions are already ongoing in this direction. Number 14, another suggestion to amend the charter, giving guidance to focus on issues of strategic and policy importance and to avoid tactical operational issues except as charged by the board. The working group agrees with the position formulated by the SAC that the current charter already indicates that SAC mission is strategic rather than operational, so no action is required. Number 15, there is a basic agreement on this. There's been a discussion whether an annual planning process has to be undertaken and the form of this annual planning process. Everybody agrees that this is needed by SAC, but it is underlined the need to set up a lightweight planning process in order not to burden, to overburden the committee with a heavy process. Then we have a minor issue, but still of substance, which is the publishing of meeting minutes on the SAC website. Full agreement with the understanding that minutes are not the same as transcript. Full agreements from the working group as well. The number 17 is about the efforts that are needed to keep updated the website of SAC. It's much more of an operational issue. There is full agreement. By the way, ICANN already allocated some additional resources to support SAC on this. There is then full agreement between SAC and the working group on a point that has been underlined by reviewers. Reviewers underlined the need to rethink the task area one of Charter, which says to develop a security framework for internet naming and other allocation services that defines the key focus areas and identifies where the responsibilities for each area lie. And all agree that this has to be removed from the present Charter. We have then a list of several agreements. I'm not going to read all of them. If you have some comments on them, it's number 19 to 22. Is about the terms of members. Is about the mechanism for membership and other issues related. George Sadowski, you raise your hand.
I
want
to go back to that one slide.
Oh. Yeah, sure.
Could you explain the rationale for that?
17 or
18?
18.
18.
Why should it be removed? Is it duplicative? Yep. Is it?
It is far too broad in the working group's review working group's view, and it's not really the role of ESSAC to develop a security framework for internet naming and address allocation services, et cetera, et cetera. It's just not inappropriate. Okay.
We can move to number 23. SAC board liaison be permitted a maximum of 3 consecutive 1-year term. Disagreement from the SAC, and the working group, by the way, in agreement with the present formulation of the board review working group report, suggested a way to consider to extend the tenure for all liaison. Now, just today, we had a discussion at the presentation of the board review report about the length of this term, and different options were formulated. Where the first was, for instance, to leave it to the nominating committees while giving a maximum number of terms. Other options were formulated: 2 years, 3 years. There is. In any case, I would say, trying also to resume from the discussion today, an interesting discussion about augmenting, raising up the length of term of liaison and trying as far as possible to align this term to the term of voting director in the board.
Yes, but one consideration that was discussed at the other meeting was that, of course, the needs and desires of the advisory committee should also be taken into account when establishing the term. But the working group felt that since the liaisons effectively operate as non-voting board members, they need the same term to get up to speed, and that churn is inappropriate.
So,
Steve.
Yeah, thank you. Two comments. When I read that, the first thing that went through my mind is that just as a matter of form, the bylaws in a different part, not related to the establishment of ESSAC, but basically I think applying to all liaisons, sets the term for liaisons to be 1 year at a time with a formal notice to be supplied a little bit more than a month before the annual general meeting. So I wasn't sure whether it was within scope for this review to be changing that bylaw or how it would relate. So I was just raising it as a question of form. If you are enlarging your purview in a sense and making a recommendation that it costs all liaisons, well, then that's fine. But I thought it was at least had to take note that it wasn't solely within a review of ESSAC per se to go fiddle with that.
Sure.
Second, as a practical matter, a very strong agreement that continuity has great value and that it's helpful for somebody to stay in place for a period of time and not to stay in place for too long a period of time. And so the question is how best to implement that. I can tell you that my taste would be that it's okay to have it be a one-year appointment, and that to establish an ethic.
Ray Polzak just pulled out the plug in a typical techie interfering manner.
Stability problem.
There you go.
To establish that continuity as a matter of practice and maybe even document it as best practice. Three-year terms are great. I can imagine that somebody could want to stay in place for 4 years or 5 years, but not 6 years, or that might make sense to make some changes. But I don't have any strong feeling about it, except that I agree with the general thrust of it. And then I had this other question about just in terms of getting all of the I's dotted and T's crossed properly, that fiddling with the term touched a different part of the bylaws, and it wasn't clear to me whether or not that was intentional or that you were cognizant that you were fiddling with that piece of the machinery as well.
It's just from the working group perspective, it's just a recommendation. It's a should. It's outside purview. It's outside the scope to actually implement such a change. But now I have Ray and then Roberto.
Well, it's nice to know after all these years, Steve, I know how I can silence you. So anyway, I just wanted to add one other comment to that discussion in the working group about the length of terms, particularly when it related to liaisons. There was also discussion about that the organizations were comfortable with their liaisons. They could repeatedly send them back. But there was a sort of a smaller conversation then about, well, maybe there could be some kind of limitation imposed as to how many times they could be sent back as well. So basically setting an overall length of service time as opposed to term limits or something like that as well. But in the end, I think that the big takeaway message was that the desires of the particular committee really were paramount here too.
Roberto?
Yeah, just for the information, the Board Review Working Group held its meeting, finished just about 1 hour ago, and the current orientation is to recommend for the liaisons to leave to the liaisons the freedom of deciding what is the length of terms. But to recommend using terms of 2 years rather than 1 year because of this need of bringing people up to speed.
Thank you, Roberto. As Ray has just said, one of the other things, of course, is being able to say thank you nicely to someone who served a number of terms and move on. And so, hence, both the term and the number of terms are important tools that the organization collectively needs. Marco, the next recommendation.
The next recommendation is about the possibility to introduce in Article 11 on the bylaws some specific provision for the removal of a member who was not performing by a simple majority vote of the board. This measure was a bit criticized by SAC in their review, and because they consider basically that the putting of this recommendation on this bylaw could seem as a sort of a punishment to the member of the committee. However, the working group considered that some protective measures should be put in place to remove underperforming or disruptive advisory committee members or chair.
Steve?
ESSAC is slightly special in that, unlike all of the other supporting organizations and advisory committees, there is no constituency, and membership in ESSAC is by appointment by the board. not specified in the bylaws currently is the rest of that machinery. Couldn't the board remove somebody? And I would say, as a board member, not with my SAC hand, but of course, if you can appoint somebody, then that would be implied. And if you need to clean up the language to say so, then you should do so. So in some sense, I would say that this maybe just adds clarity to what's already there. The board can remove the chair. The board can remove arbitrary members, including a liaison, sort of almost at will. The other side of this is that in the sense that SAC is an advisory committee, and anything that is applied to SAC has to be looked at just as a matter of form. And now I really am speaking more as a board member than as an SAC person, that what are we saying about the treatment of liaisons and in general? And that opens up a certain can of worms. Do we want to be able to tell ALAC or GAC or RSAC that we don't like your liaison and they're hereby banished and you should supply a different one? We've never had to deal with such a things, to my knowledge, and I don't know how well we would fare if we actually went and tried to do that.
Jeff, you want to have a quick comment?
Yeah, Steve's absolutely right. This is just a technical cleanup noticed by our attorney that by remaining silent on the issue of removal, it actually reverts to California law. And California law states that you would need a supermajority vote of the board of directors to remove a member of an appointed advisory committee member. And so if that's an acceptable position, then that's fine. We just recommended cleaning it up and writing it down.
I hadn't known that, but sitting as a board member, if the board wants to remove somebody, I would recommend strongly that if the board does not have a supermajority, it ought not be so quick to do it on just a simple majority. But that's just, imagining that we get into such a contentious situation.
Yeah, this is a cleanup. This is a mutual protection. It's not going to be used to target people or punish people. It's really designed that if ESSAC has a problem, there's a mechanism for resolving it.
Well, within ESSAC, we can resolve the problem. No.
Next.
Next, and we are getting closer to the end, is on branding. We got a recommendation from reviewers on the need for SAC to implement a policy stating that the SAC brand, written or verbal, has to be used only on approved work products. And SAC discussed very much the very concept of branding, considering that the concept of branding is not opportune within the SAC culture and scope of work. Some points raised by reviewers or whoever were considered very important by the working group, the draft final conclusion of the working group is in the sense that if and when applicable, when making statements, SAC members should clarify whether they refer to their personal view or to positions expressed in SAC documents to avoid any ambiguity that could be created in some circumstances. If there is no further comment on this. Number 26 is about the possibility for the SAC chair to select, implement, and enforce. Oh, thank you very much. And enforce the regular use of transparent decision making and document strategy for SAC, fitting of the membership and culture of the SAC. In the beginning, the draft report suggested also the use of some formal method, like the Robert rules or other methods to be adopted by the SAC. This reference was eliminated in the final report, and the text of the final report reviewers is, as you see on the screen. The SAC position was formulated in between the two versions of the report, between the draft and the final version of the report. So having seen the final version of the report, the working group concluded that the proposals formulated by reviewers in their final version of the report appear consistent with the culture of the SAC. So it recommend to work in this way. Number 27 is about the approval and release of all work products in agreement, well, consistently with a decision making and documentation strategy. There is disagreement, but here again, the working group concluded that this was maybe due to the previous formulation of the reviewer's report, which was the draft report. So there are no reasons, according to the working group, for not agreeing with this recommendation.
Marco, is the fact that this ESSEC disagreement was really a disagreement with an earlier version of the report, is that clear from our report, from the working group report?
I think so.
You think so? Okay,
yeah.
But maybe you just check that.
I think so, but we should check. Check. Yeah, we should.
Thank
check.
You.
Yeah.
Both.
Both. On 28, we have agreement of everybody with the recommendations of reviewer. So the adoption of suitable default confidentiality policies, agreement both from SAC and the working group. The recommendation number 29 is about the use of several mechanisms recommended in the review from external reviewers, including the annual planning process, to evaluate the SAC performances against objectives and resource utilization. There is a disagreement from SAC, which points out that the evaluating of performance is very much appropriate for employees, not for volunteer experts. On balance of those two different recommendations, recognizing value to both of them, the working group recommends SAC to produce a lightweight yearly report of activities to the board to be published as appropriate, containing information on the activities of the previous year. SAC to publish a simple conflict disclosure form for each SAC member on its website. SAC considered that for sure conflict of interest should be disclosed, but they prefer not to use formal signed statements and keep those disclosures less formal, and the working group agrees with the proposals and the approach suggested by SAC. Steve?
I'm pretty sure we've implemented this, and I'm pretty sure we've got 100%, but maybe not, of it populated. So let me recommend, if you would, to, when you have time, take a look at the ESSEC pages and just note there. And then I'm open, definitely open, to any kind of response that you have on that as to whether or not that seems satisfactory and how you feel about all that. But we've attempted to close the gap there.
Thank you, Steve. And I think that, Steve, I think that's one of the nice things about this whole process. It seems to have been a collaborative process that has ended up with everybody agreeing with one slight disagreement, which we've discussed at length, that everybody's arrived at the same point, and that's, I think, very satisfactory. But yes, we'll have a look. Marco?
We go to the very final slide of this presentation, so the last set of three recommendations on which there is agreement with the recommendations formulated by reviewers, and the agreement was expressed both by SAC and by the working group. It's about the inclusion of a decent section in the SACWAR products. It's about the inclusion of a recusal section in their work products. About the need to develop and to post a conflict of interest policy based on the ICANN board policy. Everybody agrees with those three last recommendations.
Steve?
Fundamental agreement, some very fine points. Again, we've actually begun to implement and practice and added a section to our procedures manual to document how to do this. I don't think we have anonymous recusals, and I think with respect to 33, I'm not sure that our conflict of interest policy is based upon an ICANN board policy so much as it is on our own interpretation of what to do. These are not sharp disagreements, they're just implementation details. And one other very, very fine point, I'm very sensitive to language, and it's common trap for an advisory committee, particularly one in security, to be viewed as laying down rules or making pronouncements that have to be followed. And so one of my standard sort of litanies is that we're not regulatory, we're not judicial, we don't have those kinds of powers, and that's a good thing. And along that line, there are certain words that I try to avoid because they have connotation like that. And recusal is one of those words because although in some dictionaries, it has a very broad meaning. I think the most common understanding of it is in judicial or regulatory kinds of environments. And so I've been searching for a better word. Withdrawal is the best one we've come up with. But it's just an added layer of trying to set the right tone for things.
It's a very strange word. I never met it until I came to the U.S. It's not a word that seems to be used in Europe, you excuse yourself from a discussion. There is no noun that describes excusing yourself from a discussion, as far as I'm aware, in British and Irish English.
If you find a word even beyond the limits of American English, we'd be more than happy to adopt it.
Well, the recusals is in quotes, so I think the point is covered. Anyway, Marco, that's the end of
That's the end of the presentation, and we may want to finish just having, again, a look to the timeline, just putting
before
into
the screen.
Before we do
that, George has a quick comment.
Sorry?
Yeah, I'd like to comment on number 31 regarding dissent. I like that very much. There was a time when the Committee for Economic Development in the United States had a practice of footnoting any dissents, and the footnote could be essentially of arbitrary length. And what it did was to, but it was not misused in general, it was quite short. And what it did was it provided a richness to the conversation that showed where there were differences of opinion, what they were. And for the reader, it was really very useful, and I think this may do the same thing to the extent that it's used.
Good point. Yes, indeed. Marco.
Just put on the screen the timeline to see that from the result of this discussion, very likely we will be able to reach the target and to deliver the final report by January, as we suggested at the beginning of the presentation. But reminding to everybody that we are up for public comments with the report, and the public comment will expire the 22nd of November.
Okay, unless there are any queries or further comments, Steve?
I want to just thank you both as a group and you particularly, Dennis, for your fine hand, and Marco for diligence and conscientious and just excellence in supporting and providing the meat that makes this kind of operation run smoothly.
Thank you, Steve. Just one comment, if I may. You look at that timeline, and it's a long time. Well, we weren't under any great time pressure, and we didn't have to work every weekend to do it, but nevertheless, that's the natural time for this sort of thing. And that I just make that remark because we're going into a series of affirmation of commitments reviews, which have a timeline which is, you know, 11 months for the first one, and just to highlight how much effort is going to be required to do that sort of review when it also includes two public comments. But
and this was a walk in the park, I suspect, by comparison with some that are coming.
This is absolute. This was, given the way we all worked on this and thrashed things out, this was a walk in the park. This was an easy review. Thank you, everybody. That's the end of the session. Thank you.